Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. It's a new year and a new opportunity to slim down or bulk up or lower your cholesterol. Before you go leaping into any of 2014's food trends, we're going to review the food stories that are so last year with Associated Press food editor J.M. Hirsch. J.M., great to have you back on Word of Mouth.
Thank you so much.
For you, what was the biggest food moment of 2013?
The biggest food moment? Well, certainly the loudest food moment was Paula Deen's implosion. Let's face it, Paula Deen did not have a good 2012. That's when she kind of, acknowledged that, oops, did I forget to tell you that I have diabetes and a really lucrative deal for this drug to treat diabetes? And that did not play so well. Well, this year, it was even worse.
Yeah.
And it came out in kind of a happenstance sort of way. It was a lawsuit, kind of unrelated. But it came out that she had acknowledged having used racial slurs in the past. And it pretty much tanked her. And she lost all of her endorsement deals, all of her TV shows, and people kind of fled from her. It was about a two-week period that this happened over, and we've not heard from her since.
Yeah, there were a lot of mascara-stained tears from Paula Deen.
Yes, yes. Well, and that was – a lot of people felt that even when she did apologize, she didn't quite acknowledge the depth of what she had said she'd done.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of fell flat.
How about food eating-wise?
Oh, eating-wise. Well, let's see. Sriracha. Everybody was worried about sriracha apocalypse.
Well, tell us about sriracha first. For those who, you may have seen it with the rooster on the bottle, but what is it?
The rooster bottle. A lot of people actually call it rooster sauce because they can't pronounce half of the words on the bottle. And you know what? I'm with them. Neither can I. But it's made out near L.A., and it's this – essentially, it's a hot sauce, and it's delicious. It's incredibly good. It's got this wonderful tang. It's this kind of rich depth to it that we don't get in a lot of kind of more conventional hot sauces. Anyway, people around the plant where this is made were complaining that they couldn't breathe. Mm. Fair enough. You've got a lot of chili peppers being ground up there. And so went into court, and eventually the court shut them down, saying you got to figure out a way to mitigate this so that people can actually breathe nearby. And that was the first blow. The second blow came when health inspectors said not only can't you produce it for a while, you also can't ship the stuff that's already been produced. They have to hold it and age it in the bottle for 35 days or something. So all shipments have stopped until I think sometime early next month. So you better stock up, head over to the grocery store.
What's going to happen to sriracha in 2014? Is this going to become the new eBay item?
No. You know what? They have plenty in storage that they just weren't able to ship. So it will be coming back. But whether they're going to fix the whole production process in the longer term is another issue entirely.
Well, the panic of supply, I guess, is kind of a 2013 theme. Witness the cronut.
Oh, the cronut. Goodness. Give New Yorkers something wacky to line up for, and they will do it. So this French pastry chef, Dominique Ansel, created this hybrid of a donut and a croissant. Sounds delicious. I'm sure it was quite good. And the New Yorkers went crazy for it, and it became an internet sensation. People were lining up for hours just to get one of them. And I think he was only making a couple hundred.
Right, you could only buy two at a time.
You could only buy two at a time. And people were getting them, paying people to wait in line for them. People were selling them on Craigslist and on eBay. Nothing like a crazy food to get Americans all frothy and waiting. And then, of course, the West Coast had to have their version with the ramen burger, which was basically a hamburger between two fried hunks of ramen noodles. I mean, it's exactly what it sounds like. But for us mere mortals who were not waiting in lines for hours in New York or in L.A., we were apparently going crazy for Greek yogurt, which is now, the most common food in America, it seems, or at least if you go down the grocery aisle, it certainly feels that way when you see aisle upon aisle upon aisle of every flavor combination of Greek yogurt possible. And when we weren't eating that, we were eating kale salads.
Oh, the massaged kale salad.
Kale salad.
You gave us the ingredient. You told us how to do it.
I love it. I do like my kale. I like my massaged kale salad. A little bit of lemon, some anchovies in there would be nice too. A little Parmesan. But people were going crazy about kale. And now, of course, there's the inevitable kale backlash. Now everybody's tired of hearing about kale. It's getting kind of silly, frankly. But talk about silly. Okay. Now, the dirty little secret about the food world is that people in my job hate Thanksgiving.
What?
I don't mean like we just dislike it. We hate it because everybody looks to us every single year to reinvent the turkey. Can you come up with 20 new ways to mash a potato? No, no, actually I can't. And so year after year, people in my job have to sit down and we think, what are we going to do to the bird this year? Well, anyway, this was the first year since 1888 that we've been able to say something new about Thanksgiving. And the new thing?
Hanukkah.
Hanukkah. Hanukkah, the first night of Hanukkah, fell on Thanksgiving.
Thanksgivica,
yes,
I heard it
Thanksgivica.
Called.
Oh, I've seen all sorts of variations. But who cares what you call it? It meant that we could stuff turkeys with latkes. We could put cranberry sauce in donuts. We could mash up those holidays. We finally had something fresh to say about Thanksgiving.
Some big serious stories also in 2013 for food, especially the cuts to the SNAP, or Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program, the new name for...
Right, food stamps.
Right.
Yeah, that's been one of the toughest budgetary issues in Congress that, you know, it's about an $80 billion program, and they've been tussling over how to cut it, whether to cut it, and frankly, Congress just couldn't agree, and they've just decided to disagree until sometime in January, and mm-hmm. they'll have to take it up again, and I'm sure it's not going to be any less contentious then.
And fast food workers also protesting their low wages this year.
Yes, and McDonald's seemed they seemed to kind of step in it at every point in the process. You know, they had created this website for helping their employees manage their budgets, and everything about that website apparently was wrong. And they just kept having one embarrassing moment after another. The most recent, which finally ended the site completely, was the advice on the site to avoid fast food. So,
but
take
how
that
does
one
this figure into affordable food for the rest of Americans? I mean, if fast food workers are looking for a living wage, that's going to put pressure on the fast food restaurants to raise the prices on their food. Any predictions for 2014 on that scale?
You know, I don't think we'll see prices go up any more than, you know, that they can possibly manage, because they know that Americans want a bargain. And that's the secret ingredient, frankly, to fast food in America, is that it is cheap. And of course, it's only cheap in the short term. You know, when you look at the equation down the road, and you look at the health and the economy of it all, it's not necessarily a great bargain. But when you look in the short term, and that's what we tend to do when we think about food, it is a bargain. We want our dollar menu. And so I think to tinker with that from their perspective is dangerous.
We're asking our fans on Facebook and Twitter to tell us about new foods that they may have tried this year. And we're hoping you're going to lead the way. Any insects?
You know what? There are many things I will eat. There are very few things I won't eat. But I will not be Anthony Bourdain. I will not just eat anything that crawls across my plate. I will not eat insects. I do not do tripe. I'm sorry. I just don't. But I have fallen in love this year with bourbon. Oh. I decided it was my mission to do some research and really learn to appreciate it. And boy, do I appreciate it.
All right. What do you see on the food forecast for 2014? The food critic and next Iron Chef judge Simon Majumdar told Mark Maron to be on the lookout for veal liver.
Veal liver. Mm. Well, good luck with that. Yeah. Let me know when you find it. No, I think we'll be momentarily captivated by Russian foods because, of course, the Olympics is going to be in Russia this year. I think that we can all continue to hope, cross our fingers, that the gluten-free bubble will finally burst. I've been praying for that since 2010. I think that we will see sustainable seafood take a more prominent role in the mainstream American shopping. I mean, when you look at places like Whole Foods and even, you know, our chains here, mm-hmm. Hannaford and so forth, you can see that they're doing a lot more with sustainable seafood. And I think 2013 was kind of the year of the vegetable. There was this greater appreciation for produce mm-hmm. and kind of in its more natural state and presenting it in that way. I think that Americans are swinging around to kind of sustainable seafood. Mm-hmm. And I think you're going to see a lot more of it showing up both in restaurants and sometimes more importantly in the grocery stores where we shop or at home. Because while restaurants often lead trends, they don't tend to get a critical mass until we bring them into our homes.
J.M. Hirsch, Associated Press food editor and author of The Lunchbox Blues, the book and the blog. And we'd love to hear from you. Did you have any great food departures or adventures in 2013? Did you cook for Thanksgivica? Massage some kale? Try something new? A great new restaurant? Let us know on our Facebook page, Word of Mouth Radio, or on Twitter, at Word of Mouth.
Now stay with us for the writer and philosopher Roman Krznarek, whose approach to tackling the big picture questions and challenges of our modern life is to look back to history. We'll talk about his new book, How Should We Live?, along with getting some examples for living from Leonardo da Vinci, Henry David Thoreau, and more when Word of Mouth continues. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Today, no job is a job for life. We live longer, but will likely retire with less. We now interact with friends more online than in person. Value is measured in page views, and how we choose to live could have severe consequences for the future of the planet. So, how to pursue a life that has meaning and richness in today's complicated world? Roman Krznarek suggests looking to the past. We spoke to him last year about finding fulfilling work. Now he's out with a new book called How Should We Live?, which peers into the near and ancient past for examples of how people through the ages approached love and work and family and time and money and death and creativity and other human challenges. Roman Krznarek, welcome back to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me on, Virginia.
You draw a lot of parallels between the changes in the way that we approached family, relationships, childcare, the concept of the housewife. There are a lot of things, Rubicons of sorts, that we cross in the industrial era. Talk to us about that. What is it about the model of production that changed how we live our lives?
Well, one thing has to do with parenting. So before the Industrial Revolution, not many people know this, but men actually were much more involved in childcare than they are today. And today we think that the super dad who can change nappies, diapers blindfolded is a modern invention. But no, actually go back to pre-industrial America or Europe, you'll find that men were tended to be working more around the household, sometimes in craft or agriculture, and that meant they were more around in the home. And also partly because women died younger and in childbirth, men were taking on more of those domestic tasks. Maybe they didn't necessarily rock the cradle or the crib, but they certainly made it and cut the hay for it. From childcare, you can move to things like time. I think the Industrial Revolution and factory work change the way we think about time. You know, today, 25% of Americans say that they always feel rushed. And part of the reason is because we started being rushed by industrial time. You know, even just look at how clocks were invented and changed. In the medieval period, clocks used to chime only once an hour. By the year 1700, they had minute hands on them. By 1800, they had second hands. You know, time was being sliced up into smaller and smaller periods, and we've inherited this high-stress, high-speed legacy.
But you urge us to reinvent time, and I'm wondering how. I mean, if everybody is on the same clock and buys into this idea, this need for real-time response that we're rushing about, how do we alone begin to rethink it, and what difference does that make?
I think the first thing to do is to get a bit of historical perspective and think, look, Leonardo da Vinci, he wasn't constantly looking at his watch or checking his electronic calendar when he was painting The Last Supper. You know, it doesn't have to be this way, and our obsession with time is something of a social invention. I mean, the first thing to do, I think, is to try some, you know, putting yourself on a chronological diet, I like to think of it. So try and spend a weekend without a watch, without clocks surrounding every wall around you in your house. And it could be a total disaster, but you might find it strangely liberating. But equally, I think we can indulge in slow time activities. If you go to a museum or art gallery, don't try and see everything. Go and see one room or even one painting and see what it does to you. I mean, something I do every morning, in fact, which I did this morning, which is I go out into my garden or into a park and try and find one thing that has just changed, a tiny little change in nature. And it brings a moment of stillness into the day and I think can help us at least deal with some of that overload of emails and phone calls we're constantly getting and put you into a bit of a different zone.
We're speaking with Roman Krznarek. He's a cultural thinker. He's a founding faculty member of the School of Life in London. And he's out with a new book called How Should We Live? It's a book about looking to history to solve some of our modern problems. One of the things I noticed in your book, John Maynard Keynes predicting that we will have so much free time in the future, sped up, you know, by our increased technology, that we'll have to figure out what to do with it. Now, meanwhile, we are actually working less than people were in his time,
but feel like we are working more? How do we actually change our perceptions of how we work based on looking at history?
Yeah, the economist John Maynard Keynes was a smart man, but he was very bad at predicting the future in some ways. I mean, he really did think that our biggest problem will be dealing with our abundant leisure time, because we will have had so much industrial progress, we would only have to work 4 hours a day. Now, we all know that he was remarkably wrong. And the reason he was wrong is because he didn't predict that we were going to keep ratcheting up our levels of consumption, that we'd want faster cars and bigger homes and nicer clothes. We keep pushing ourselves to work harder and harder and harder to earn more and more money because of the, what I think, a somewhat mistaken idea that the good life comes from material possessions and consumer lifestyles. And I think there's growing evidence that it just isn't the case, that as your income goes up, of course your happiness goes up for a while, but then it will stop rising up as quickly as your income and will begin to level off, and you're going to be looking for deeper things in life. And so I think that we need to, in a way, rethink our attitude to consumer lifestyle, and particularly around Christmas time, where people are, you know, spending lots of money and shopping and so on. You can actually start looking to the past, to the amazing examples of simple living in history.
The question is whether we can do this. We can pull away from the way that we've been doing things. You write in the book about the inheritance of belief. You know, how many of us just pick up the habits of our parents or our cultures. A great Einstein quote featured in there: common sense is the collection of prejudices acquired by the age of 18. So, Roman, we sit here, we read your book, we discuss it, we think about how we could be living differently. But how do we actually pull ourselves away from a culture that believes that giving great Christmas presents gives you value, or believes that success can be measured by how many views you get or how many people are searching for you on the internet?
I think one thing to do is to try and look back to inspiring figures from history, people who broke the rules, people who experimented, and see what you can learn from them. Take, for example, someone that everybody knows, the great 19th century American naturalist Henry David Thoreau, the man who said that man is rich in proportion to the number of things which he can afford to let alone. Now, of course, he went out in the 1840s to live in the woods of Massachusetts for a couple of years in a log cabin he built himself. And a lot of people will think, well, I can't go and live in a log cabin, you know, for a couple of years. This is just utopian to try and learn from someone like him. But in fact, someone like Thoreau, I think, was a very modern person who believed you could live more simply and without all those Christmas presents, even in an urban environment. I think he thought that, you know, you could build more of your own furniture, buy secondhand clothes, drop down your consumption levels, and think about that your real luxuries are not a plush sofa, but something like having time to spend with your friends and with your children, or for going for long walks in nature and things like that. And of course, you have to do experiments. For example, I recommend that people try doing what I think of as a needs and wants experiment. So for 1 month, make a note of every single thing you spend, from shoelaces to your mortgage payments, and simply label each item as a need or a want. And then in the following month, see if you can halve the amount that you spent on your wants. And, you know, that, again, could be a disaster, but you might find it really quite uplifting.
I'll start after New Year's.
That's cheating.
Roman Krasnarek, he's a cultural thinker. He's a founding faculty member of the School of Life in London. And he's out with a new book called How Should We Live? It's a book about looking to history to solve some of our modern problems. One of the things that really touched me in this book is writing about what you call death style. First of all, define that for us.
Well, if you open a newspaper, they're full of lifestyle sections, and I think there should be death style sections as well. And by death style, I mean the art of growing old and facing your mortality and dying well. And I think it's really important to think about that, because we live in a society that tries to shield us very much from death. You know, death is still pretty much a taboo topic of conversation, just like sex was in the 19th century. So I'm all for trying to start conversations about death.
So you look back through history to the ancients and to more recent past, when death was much closer to the way that people lived. What can we learn about that from our own fear and sanitization, as some people accuse, of death?
I think it's absolutely fascinating to go back to the medieval period in Europe, when death was absolutely everywhere. That was partly because people were dying young at the age of 30 or 40. It was also because death iconography was everywhere. There were paintings of skeletons dancing on the walls of churches. People even wore brooches and jewelry full of skulls and crossbones. And the idea really was that if you had death very much present to you, it gave people, and this is really extraordinary, a love of life that I think we don't have today when we're spending on average 4 hours a day watching television.
You write about Philippe Petit, the high wire artist who strung a high wire between the World Trade Towers in the 1970s, about the Mexican Day of the Dead celebrations and the New Orleans jazz funerals. How do you tie those together? What do they suggest to us about the way that we should be living our life today?
I think examples like the high wire artist Philippe Petit is telling us to take more risks with our lives. And I think this is one of the great lessons that runs through the history of humanity, that people who have lived deep and sucked all the marrow from life have taken risks. They have gone against the norm. They've experimented with their jobs or where they lived, how they had conversations, all these different areas of life. So I think we can look to them, but I think also we can look to other cultures, as you say, the Mexican Day of the Dead or the New Orleans jazz funerals, and think, okay, here are cultures where death is very much present. So let's talk about death. Let's talk with our friends about what kind of funeral you're going to like, or even, I think, in a way, celebrate the small deaths of everyday life. You know, I have little children, and I think to myself now, my daughter is only going to be learning to talk once, so why stay up late at work answering emails when I could be with her for this one moment which is going to pass, the little death of her childhood? And I think I should try and be there for it. And that reminder of the presence of these small deaths in everyday life, I think, can bring us back into the present.
Roman Krznarek is a cultural thinker, writer, and founding faculty member of the School of Life in London. He's author of the new book, How Should We Live? We have more on his books for the School of Life series and the new book, including some terrific reviews, at wordofmouthradio.org. On Sunday, Downton Abbey fans will be treated to the premiere of the fourth season of the acclaimed series on public television. Yes, we've lost some beloved characters, and the fortunes of the Yorkshire estate of the Earl and Countess of Grantham have risen and fallen and risen again. But the service remains impeccable, thanks to Carson the Butler, here educating second footman Alfred in the ways of the proper spoon.
Go on, then.
Teaspoon, egg spoon, melon spoon, grapefruit spoon, jam spoon.
Shall I tell you?
All right.
A bouillon spoon.
But I thought soup spoons were the same as tablespoons.
Ah, so they are, but not for bouillon, which is drunk from a smaller dish.
While that level of persnickety table setting may be a thing of the past, careers in service to the extremely wealthy are not. The number of U.S. billionaires doubled in the past decade, and those hedge fund managers, CEOs, and celebrities need trained staff to manage their many estates. That is the goal of Starkey International Institute of Household Management in Denver. For about $20,000, students can learn how to oversee and care for today's great estates. Freelance writer John P. Davidson attended what's called the Butler Boot Camp at Starkey and wrote about it for the January issue of Harper's Magazine. John Davidson, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure, Virginia.
You introduced the Starkey International Institute to us as a portal into the alternate reality of our new gilded age. Expand on that, a little bit about the setting and the program.
Well, the school is in a mansion near downtown Denver. It's an old Edwardian-style mansion. People go there hoping to enter this world of the super rich. It's sort of interesting because the school is two blocks from Colfax, which is Denver's Skid Row. So you're in two different worlds there.
How long does the program last, and what does it consist of?
The program I was in was 8 weeks. We learned how to set tables. It's very persnickety about that in that sense. We learned how to iron shirts and how to fold clothes and scrub floors. There's a cooking component and a wine component. And then we're trained in things like boundaries. How do you address your principles? How should you be addressed? How do you maintain your independence in the house? It's a very interesting look into that world and into what those houses are like and what those lives are like.
The school was founded in 1981 by a woman named Mary Louise Starkey. Now, who are her clients, or is it those looking for trained butlers or the trainees themselves?
She takes students and she places the students if she can, and her commission or her fee is 30% of the first year's salary. And then she also does consulting for the ultra wealthy. She says her clients start, that their net worth starts at about $300 million. And then people come to her looking for staff.
You write in your article that there are an estimated 450,000 homes in the U.S. that have some kind of regular staff. And it was made clear to you that the advantage of attending the Starkey School was a kind of near promise of placement in a household. Now, first of all, for what kind of salaries? And secondly, did they deliver on that promise?
The salaries for household managers started about $60,000. And go up to 80, and I don't know how high they go. An estate manager for running multiple properties or a very large estate might make as much as $200,000. And what I discovered in the program was that what people want is experience in the house. And if you, one of the first questions they'll say, do you have in-home experience? Just having a certification. In some cases, it's enough for some people, but not necessarily.
You heard from the staff and from stories about alums, about where they had been placed. I'm curious about some of the things you learned about what you call the principals, the extremely wealthy, the 1%'s 1%, you also call it. What do they expect from estate managers and from staff?
Oh, goodness, everything. Running these big houses is... They're very complicated. There are always projects that have to be done. There are all sorts of vendors who come to the houses to do everything from roofing to plumbing to florist. And a good estate manager needs to know everything about the house, who's there, what they're doing there, what they need, what they want. It can be putting toothpaste on a toothbrush or cleaning
really?
Somebody's eyeglasses. Yes, yes. And there's one family that we heard about, you know, very wealthy family, and the family does not handle money or credit cards. They don't touch money. If they want something, they ask one of their staff to get it for them.
Well, it does take a special kind of person to be willing to do service, to be, you know, at the beck and call of all hours, putting toothpaste on a toothbrush. Tell us a little about your fellow students who you all had to refer to as Mr. or Ms. What do you think they were looking for good jobs or to just be in this wealthy orbit?
I think both. During financial hard times, we just, you know, we're coming out of a recession, and people were looking for jobs and looking for a world where money is not such a problem. A lot of people have a sense that they would like to run a house and they would like to do it really well. A lot of military people are drawn to this, former military people, because they're used to serving and they're happy to take orders. So it was a mixed group of people. It was an impressive group of people, I thought.
I also was interested in hearing about their age. These are not college graduates necessarily.
No, and being too young is not a good idea because they want mature people running their affairs. And, you know, being too old is not a good idea either. Couples do quite well. A lot of people specify gay men specifically because they feel like that they're obsessive compulsive, and which, you know, that's sort of stereotyping,
you
I guess.
Quite a sweep.
I think the theory is also that if you are very rich and elderly and you have a trophy wife, if you have a gay butler, you don't have to worry about your wife so much.
Well, John, you provide us with a little bit of history of how the help was stratified in the past to be kept mostly hidden, treated not quite so kindly as those in Downton Abbey. Now, how were you treated in this program?
Well, I thought of it as being a bit like joining a cult or something, or being on a reality television show. there was a lot of screaming and a lot of shouting and being ordered about.
You mean by the faculty, by the owner of the school?
Yes. And we were told at the beginning of the program that we were being trained as professionals. We were not servants, but the program was set up so that we were treated as servants. We had to use the back stairs in the house. We couldn't use the front stairs. Everybody was Mr. and Miss. Our first names weren't used. And if you were told to do something, you did it. It wasn't collegial in any way.
Could it be argued that in a program like this, where people are learning to be in the households of people who were, you know, busy, high-strung, often CEOs, heads of company, mm-hmm. used to yelling at people, there could be some value in, toughening up your hide?
Possibly. Yes, Mrs. Starkey says that 60% of the program is psychological, and I interpreted this, say, like this going through boot camp in the service, that they break you down and then they remake you the way they want. And a lot of the stories we heard about principals, a lot of the anecdotes that we heard at the at Starkey were about principals being extremely whimsical and mercurial and demanding and often irrational.
Well, now, you know, people are going to be watching Downton Abbey over the weekend mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. loving the program and mm-hmm. the dedication of those who are in the downstairs or below stairs, I guess they would say. What do you think has made that show, that concept of those doing service, so popular? I mean, is there a kind of nostalgia for elegant manners or what's going on here?
It's definitely nostalgia. And I think there's, in Downton Abbey or upstairs, downstairs, both, they looked to a certain extent like a safe world and a complete world. It's also a very odd and unusual symbiotic relationship that that takes place between principals and staff, and that goes back to, you know, Edwardian and Victorian England, and before that, the servants, the hierarchies and household staffs reflected the hierarchies in the aristocracy.
Don Davidson, you did your share of ironing tablecloths and setting tables and organizing closets and scrubbing toilets. Do you think you are cut out for a life of service?
I learned that I'm not really cut out for it.
Don Davidson, freelance writer. He's based in Austin, Texas. Thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
You can read John's article about attending the Starkey International Butler Boot Camp, or so it's called, in the January 2014 issue of Harper's Magazine. His novel, The Obedient Assassin, is coming out in January of 2014.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. The Golden Globe and SAG Award nominations are out, launching award season into full effect. Among those getting the most nods are director Steve McQueen's 12 Years a Slave and David O. Russell's American Hustle. We are not going to tread through the all-too-familiar best of 2013 territory today. We're forging a new path through the worst films of the year. Take Getaway, starring Selena Gomez and Ethan Hawke, which, according to Rotten Tomatoes, only 2% of critics actually liked.
What are you doing?
I am doing whatever he asks, or they're going to murder my wife.
This car belongs to me.
What?
It's good to see you getting along.
You will need her help if you want your wife back.
That's some good stuff there. Getaway. Joining me now is Bill Goodykuntz. He's chief film critic for Gannett in the Arizona Republic. Bill, great to have you back on Word of Mouth.
Oh, it's great to be here.
People often do think of the life of a film critic as very exciting. You know, you get a jump on so many great movies. Is there any joy in reviewing really bad movies?
If it's bad in an interesting way,
That can be fun to write about. It's too easy, I think, and some critics fall into this trap. The bad films are the ones where it's too easy to try to show off and be, like, really super mean. And, I've said some pretty bad things. I can't remember some Adam Sandler movie once. I think I said that I was – it made me more stupid just for having watched it, and I felt like I was already not as mad as I was, but when I went in. But some are just – like, the sooner you're out of the theater, where I should say, at least in my case, as soon as I hit send on the review, they're out of my mind. And that's why it's actually kind of tough to come up with a bottom 10 list, because you haven't thought about them all year once they're gone,
Well, what makes a film bad?
Typically, it's lazy, or it's trying to take advantage of the audience. It's just, it's going to try to hook you with a name or with a concept, and they're really not going to execute it very well. And they don't even try, because they know they're going to get you for some of these things. I mean, the clip that you just played, Ethan Hawke, by the way, is also in one of the best movies of the year this year, Before Midnight.
Mm-hmm.
It always reminds me of the famous quote attributed to Michael Caine, where, why were you in Jaws 2, The Revenge, or whatever? And he said, I've never seen it. I hear it's very bad. You should see The House That Built Me.
Were there any films on your worst list that you were really excited to see, given the talent?
Yeah, I mean, that can be an issue also. I mean, I think that sometimes you expect more and you're disappointed. For instance, the film The Internship with Vince Vaughn and Owen Wilson, they played like these aging guys who got internships at Google. It was ridiculous, and now it's disappointing because both of those guys are funny. I mean, you think about movies like Wedding Crashers where they were together. That was a really funny movie. I mean, it wasn't, Citizen Kane or anything, but it was good, and they were really funny. This movie just, it was just ridiculous, and it was, again, it was just lazy. It was these two guys kind of resting on their reputation. Anybody that saw Wedding Crashers is probably going to give this one a chance, right? And then there's a movie like The Lone Ranger, which, has Johnny Depp in it. I teamed in with Gore Verbinski, the director, who they did the first couple of Pirates of the Caribbean movies together and then got that rolling. And you think, that might be kind of cool. The Lone Ranger, we haven't thought about The Lone Ranger in a long time. And then you come and it's just this big, bloated, overdone mess that just would not end. A movie's got too much when not only is there a train chase at the end, there's a dueling train chase at the end with two trains. So twice the mayhem and explosions and whatnot. That movie was probably better than some other movies that didn't make this list, but it was such a disappointment.
There were a lot of people banking on that being a big hit, and I'm guessing for the film like Last Vegas with Robert De Niro, Morgan Freeman, Michael Douglas, Kevin Kline, all Oscar winners or nominees. Let's hear just a little clip of that.
Now, we're here together, the four of us. We're here to celebrate Billy marrying an infant.
She's not an infant.
Shut up, Billy.
Archie, blood pressure?
Either you'll manage to be civil with each other, or so help me, I'm going to rain holy hell down on both of you. I'm going to go find some damn water and take all my damn pills. Then we're going to get this damn party started.
How did you rate Las Vegas?
The fourth worst movie of the year. I hated it, and it's a shame. I talked to Morgan Freeman for it, which is great. But I just thought talk about lazy and really sort of sad. I mean, those four men have done some of the best work of any actors in the last 40 years, right? And now it's like four guys, in Las Vegas with a bunch of Viagra jokes. It was disappointing to me. I'll say this, however, I got a ton of emails from older people who saw it, and they loved it. And it was the classic retort when people don't like what I've written. It's like, did you see the same movie I did? I think so. Were these four really great actors in it doing really bad things?
Then there are the films that just retread old storylines, hoping to cash in, like Disney's Planes. Also, The Host. This is adapted from Stephanie Meyer of Twilight fame's novel, The Host. Now, why did these two flop?
Planes was just, it reminded me a lot of Cars, or Cars 2, which just came out last year. It's, this sort of unlikely hero who's a plane, who his problem is he's afraid of heights, which, as you might imagine, is not that great if you're going to be a racing plane. I just found it, like, they weren't even trying. I mean, it was a real disappointment. I think we got spoiled with animated films for a while there. I mean, I think when there's a new Toy Story coming out every couple of years, one great one after another, I think that kind of got us spoiled. And then, we haven't had one in a while. And certainly
Flames didn't do anything to distinguish Disney. House at the end of the year, though, Frozen, I think, is a terrific film, and that's more of a return to form.
I wonder if the studios are underestimating the audience. You've said a couple times, you know, don't even try. They're lazy. But do new ideas sell, like even these old retreads?
No. Of course not.
There you go.
From a business standpoint, it makes perfect sense. But, I don't care if they make money. I care if they're any good. I'm going to sit there and watch them, you know. Of course. That's why Transformer movies, they can just roll them out the door and they'll make $400 million. Who knows why people keep going to them? There's some familiarity. Maybe you like one of the stars. People, I don't think it's wrong to say that people kind of like big, loud movies where stuff blows up. I mean, they always have.
Here's one film that I would say might make it into that so bad it's kind of good category, or at least you know that it might make cult status. Here's a clip from The Canyon, starring Lindsay Lohan and the adult film star James Dean.
Hi.
What'd you do today?
I went to the gym.
Which gym?
Equinox, the gym that I'm a member of.
The one in Westwood or the one on Sunset?
The one in West Hollywood.
Why'd you go to the one in West Hollywood?
Well, because it was closer to where I was meeting Gina for lunch.
What time did you go to the gym?
That's entertainment.
No, it's not.
What do you think, Bill? What makes a film cross over into that, like, so bad it's good cult status?
Well, if you can laugh, sort of, even if you can laugh at it, but not necessarily with it, that'll work. But that movie, I wanted it to be that kind of so bad it's good sort of campy thing. It wasn't. It was just depressing. I mean, it was awful. You just feel bad for having watched it. And you feel bad for her. She was really, Lindsay Lohan was a really talented young actress, yeah. You know. And it's just depressing. I mean, it's just a bad movie. Bad in that way that you don't just feel bad for them. You feel bad for yourself for having spent 90 minutes in front of it, you know.
Bill Goodykunz, chief film critic for Gannett and the Arizona Republic, thank you for your time and for your good taste.
Thank you.
So what gets your vote for the worst movie of the year? You can join the mudslinging conversation already in progress on our Facebook page, Word of Mouth Radio, or on Twitter, at Word of Mouth.
No war hangers! What's wire hangers doing in this closet when I told you no wire hangers ever?
...2013's share of bad movies is in keeping with Hollywood's long history of producing schlock. Comedian Dana Gould is host of the podcast The Dana Gould Hour and an unapologetic fan of B-movies, or worse. Here he is with the story of one of the genre's great stars who bore the heavy mantle of a famous name.
Here's a manly thing that I don't get. Giving your son your name and then making him add Junior to the end of it. Just a simple, easy way of ensuring your child go through their entire life feeling that they are, at best, nothing more than a lesser version of you. Think about the life sentence that is the name Frank Sinatra Jr. How is that anything other than child abuse? It's as if John Lennon made his son perform in a band, but he forced them to call themselves the Other Beatles. Good luck, guys. Now, there is one famous junior who wanted nothing to do with his father's name. In fact, he wasn't even born with it. He was forced to take it later in life just to put food on the table. Lon Chaney Jr., the star of the original The Wolfman. He was born Creighton Tull Chaney. Now, he was the son of Lon Chaney, who we will now call Lon Chaney Sr., who was known across the globe in the 1920s as the Man of a Thousand Faces. Lon Chaney Sr. was one of the biggest movie stars of the silent era. So famous, in fact, that when he died in 1930, his passing did not just make the front page of the New York Times. It was the headline. Creighton Tull Chaney had some daddy issues, believe you me. In fact, he didn't even think about going into acting until after his dad was safe in the ground. The name Junior didn't come until studio heads at Universal convinced him that after years of struggling as Creighton, he could increase his income by about 1,000,000% by changing his name to his dad's. So he did, around 1935. And he never forgave himself. Despite scoring a pretty big win as the simpleton Lenny, in 1939's Of Mice and Men with Burgess Meredith, Lon Jr. spent his early career giving uninspired performances in uninspired westerns. Unlike his father, who was a flamboyant theatrical artiste, Lon Jr. fancied himself just a regular Joe, a ham and egger. He liked nothing more than drinking, wrestling, drinking, and drinking, and drinking. This might not have helped his liver much, but it did lead to the performance that would define his career. In 1941, Lon Chaney Jr. won the role of Larry Talbot, otherwise known to the world as the Wolfman. And he gave the role a sense of emotional heft that towered over any other performance he would ever give. Larry Talbot knew that when the moon was full, he was powerless over his actions, and he would wake up the next morning in disheveled clothes, not knowing what he did or where he'd been. For Lon, who waged a lifelong battle with very real liquid demons, the role fit him like a beer koozie. Now, when I was a kid, the Wolfman was my favorite monster. You see, unlike Godzilla or Frankenstein or even King Kong, who you could say are about anarchy, just smashing things, the Wolfman is about guilt. Shame and guilt. And I can relate. On the one hand, I was raised a very strict Catholic. And on the other hand, well, you can imagine what was going on the other hand, hence all the shame and guilt. Now, if you haven't seen the original 1941 version of The Wolfman, or if you haven't seen it in a long time, you should give it a look. It's great. There are some goofy things. For one, in the movie, Larry Talbot is the son of an English nobleman, Sir John Talbot, played by Claude Rains.
You know, Larry, but isn't it a sad commentary on our relationship that it took a hunting accident and your brother's death to bring you?
That is Sir John Talbot. And now here is his son. Listen to Lon Chaney Jr.'s expert British accent.
Well, it really isn't as bad as it sounds. I watched every bit of news about you. I was mighty proud when you won the Belden Prize for Research.
My God, he sounds just like Ringo. The Wolfman is full of father-son conflicts. Here's a spoiler alert. It's Larry's own father in the film who kills his son in the end. But the movie made Lon a star. And over the course of the next few years, Lon Chaney Jr. played every monster Universal Studios had. Dracula, Frankenstein, the Mummy. And he brought to those roles pretty much nothing. His job in the Frankenstein and the Mummy movies was to just walk around. And he did literally that, giving the roles none of the silent poetry that Boris Karloff seemed to so effortlessly give them. But every time he played the Wolfman, which he did four more times in the 1940s, that oh-so-haunted look would return to those big, sad, rummy eyes, and he knocked it out of the park every time. Lon Chaney Jr. ended his career in schlocky B-movies, stuff like 1959's The Alligator People, where he has classic lines like,
"Dirty, stinking, slimy gators! You bit my hand off, didn't you? Well, I'm gonna spend the rest of my life killing gators. The rest of my life."
Seems like an odd thing to dedicate yourself to.
I ain't never gonna stop shooting gators.
You know what I think is a fun hobby? Doing puzzles.
I ain't never gonna stop shooting gators!
There's another great bit in here that I'm going to throw in, apropos of nothing. When the heroine of the film realizes the result of the mad scientist's evil experiments.
Your patients are turning into alligators.
Alligator people.
Oh, alligator people. Lon Chaney Jr. died of heart failure in 1973. Because silent movies are not really enjoyed in the masses, he has easily eclipsed his father in the fame department, although Lord only knows what was going on in that head of his. His friends describe him as a sweet, yet terribly sad man.
The way you walked was thorny, through no fault of your own. But as the rain enters the soil, the river enters the sea. So tears run to a predestined end.
Ah, the Wolfman. You gotta see it.
And that's from the Dana Gould Hour podcast. You'll find more on bad films like The Alligator People, along with a good laugh on Dana's podcast. There's a link to find it at wordofmouthradio.org. Thank you for spending some time with us today. We do invite you to share what you heard with others. You can go to wordofmouthradio.org for a deep catalog of conversations to listen to post on social media, or to email on to your friends. I'm Virginia Prescott. Until next time, this is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Zach Nugent,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its board of trustees,
or its underwriters.
To subscribe to our podcasts and listen to past shows,
go to wordofmouthradio.org.
You can also join us on Facebook at Word of Mouth Radio.
Follow us on Twitter at Word of Mouth.
And check out a playlist of music from the program on Spotify.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.